I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of the Same Old Wombles podcast. We're brought to you by some of us who put together Yellow and Blue back in the day. We're non-affiliated, independent, and non-partisan. We're the Same Old Wombles. My name is Mark Lewis. When you create hope in people, you create expectations. Tonight's panel features Alex Foulkes and Adam Proctor, with our returning special guest, first one to return, I believe, Women's Media Officer at AFC Wimbledon. Big welcome to George Jones.
Hello, thank you for having me on again.
Pleasure. Quick special shout out at the top to Pete Jones, one of our listeners, who I understand is someone who's listened to all 25 episodes so far. And fingers crossed we'll do him proud tonight. On tonight's show, is the playoff pushed dead? And if so, what happens for the rest of the season? What's our opinion of the interview about Craig Cope that went out late on Friday night on their website? And we're going to talk to George about the women's team, a review of how they're getting on the rest of their season to date and the challenges they face. And of course, we'll have some numbers. Welcome to episode 26.
All I want to do is watch football. All I want to do is watch football. We fell down, we fell broke, like we ain't got a hope. Like the times when you're down to 10. What can you do when they're coming at you? You gotta take it back to them.
There you go. And without Matt, there's no one to jump in at this point.
It's going to be quiet this week. There's going to be no one jumping in.
No Coopers. No Coopers. It's brilliant, isn't it? So we can talk about all that stuff that Niall normally knows everything about and won't let anybody else get a word in edgeways.
So how are we, chaps? Have we recovered from the disappointment of Saturday afternoon?
Let's talk about that game, because it was... For the first time in a couple of weeks, it was a game against a team below us in the league. It was a game against a team who are threatened with relegation, who we should have beaten, who didn't really offer very much except at set pieces. And we went one goal up and it was a nice goal. And we thought, OK, we're doing all right here. We're cruising a bit. We got that comfort second goal and we thought, oh, yes, this is it. This is it. Maybe we score a few more. Improve the goal difference. Maybe we just sit back and accept that. And then Pierce went off. And I didn't know at the time that it was an injury, in which case, obviously, he had to go off. We got Pierre on and suddenly the defence went to tatters. And we conceded two pretty much dodgy goals that we really shouldn't have conceded. We spurned a load more chances. We had 20 shots overall. We only scored two goals. You know, when we were 2-0 up, you look at it and you think, well, that doesn't matter. We're still going to win this game. But looking back on it, it was horribly disappointing. I walked away anyway, feeling much as I do after a defeat, rather than that we got a draw out of it. That was pretty horrendous. And, you know, the mood music from the club since then has been pretty good. They recognise where the failing was. Obviously, there are plus points from the game. Ali Ahmadi got his first goal. DJ looked really good. A couple of other players looked really good. It's just, you know, that defensive lapse just made us feel a bit ordinary. So, yeah, my vote would be the playoffs, if they ever were a realistic opportunity, are now gone.
Yeah, I feel that it felt like a defeat at the end. And I think, to be honest, it probably should have been. I mean, Hartlepool had a couple of really good chances right in the last seconds of injury time that they could have put away. And that would have been, you know, definitely the end of our playoff position. But I think it's probably over already. I'll be honest, I didn't think they were possible going into the game. I thought it was probably one step too far for us this year. But it's definitely over now. And it's... You're right. The point the game changed was when Piercy went off, obviously with that groin strain, and Aaron Pierre came on and he looked rusty. You could see he hasn't played a game in 2 years effectively at this point. But it's it weren't good. And all it did is show and expose what we've been for the last few months, which is we've got nothing going forward or very little going forward. And we were solid at the back, but the second we lose that defensive stability, we collapse into a team that's threatening towards the bottom four rather than the playoffs. And I mean, for me, the disappointing thing from Saturday was Armani Little. I've sung his praises a lot. I think he's been our best signing in January, but it was his worst game for us, and he was badly at fault for their equalising goal. Not a great day at the office for us, but hopefully DJ and a couple of the others signings, like you said, Al Hamidi getting his first goal, they're starting to hit a bit of form, and hopefully we can start to create something going forward.
So my question for Adam, who I know wasn't at the game, I'm guessing you were following it. How does a game like that look? Because those of us that were there feel that we should have been 3 or 4 nil up, as the guys have explained, and weren't, and paid the price by letting a 5'6" guy have a open goal header in the 6-yard box in the 96th minute. But following it on BBC, on Sky, or whatever, apart from seeing Jeff Stelling lose it when they equalised, how frustrating was that?
Well, I wasn't following it live because I was actually working, so I couldn't even look at my phone. But I obviously looked at my phone and there was about 5,000 WhatsApp messages. And I thought, oh, okay, this is probably not good. So, yeah, my experience was scrolling through WhatsApp and I was just like, what the heck? I mean, well, it's weird because I don't know, I reckon the whole team listened to this podcast and anything I say, they decide to go in the complete opposite direction because I said we've got trouble with scoring goals. And I'm like, hang on a minute, we've scored 2 goals. And then I'm like, no, I mean, I think in the middle of my open day, I probably blurted out, 96th minute, what the heck? Which I was probably thinking, what is he doing? I couldn't have got one. I was working, so I couldn't get there. Then there was no trains, which made it so it wasn't as bad because I knew that I couldn't get there anyway. And then, yeah, I was a bit frustrated. I just frustrated. But I mean, as you guys know, I like that Don's vlog thing where the guy videos the stuff of his son and his dad, and after, he does a really good job of it and get loads more highlights. So I've watched that, and they're always pretty upbeat and quite chipper. But you could see at the end of the video, they were pretty depressed at the score of the result as well. So I was disappointed. I felt that it was a game that we should have hung on to, and I wasn't there to know exactly what changed and why those things changed. And you don't really see that in the highlights, obviously. But yeah, it was disappointing. Also, one of the goals obviously was down the end where we sit. And I was just like, there's been so many games recently where the goals have been at the wrong end, as far as I'm concerned. I was like, I could have seen that goal. But anyway.
Yeah, we scored 2 decent goals. A break down the left side. Lee Brown actually had a decent, solid game, even though I think most of us want Curry to play. Put in a decent ball. Al Hamidi scored.
Yeah, that first goal was really... I thought the play for that first goal was fantastic, actually, in terms of when you watched it on the replay. It just looked like really good build-up play.
But even the second, Chislett, I don't think has justified his place in the team for about the last month. But Saturday, he had the strongest game he's had for a long time, playing on the left rather than the right, as he has done most recently, properly getting involved, getting stuck in, getting probably as many tackles in as Little has recently, actually, even though he was wide right. And again, you could argue that when he was taken off, that possibly didn't help balance-wise either. But the goal was created by Chislett attacking the box, getting a proper strike in, not a great save, pushed to the side, and DJ follows it up and slams it in. At which point, we're cruising, and we should have cruised towards the end, frankly. The guy got a decent free kick almost immediately after Pierce was taken off injured. But, I said to myself before that we let the second equaliser in, this is the type of situation where a couple of years ago when we were sliding through League One, we'd let in a goal now. But I said it to myself as opposed to out loud because I didn't want to jinx it. And obviously, even saying it to myself jinxed it. But that's, I guess, frankly, as much as anybody wants to say about the Hartlepool game, because I drove home with my wife and my daughter without a word being said whatsoever from 3 talkative people, which is never a good sign after a football match. So I'm going to move on from that, and I'm going to segue neatly into Mr. Alex Folkes, who's going to give us a little bit of an update of his opinions relating to football governance.
Yeah, it's a bit of a rant. I haven't had a decent rant for ages. So, if you remember, when Newcastle United got taken over by PIF, which is this investment arm of the Saudi government, although when they took over, the owners and directors test, they insisted that they were not part of the Saudi government. And the Premier League claims to have written guarantees that they are not part of the Saudi government. Okay, we don't necessarily believe them, but so be it. This week in a court in America, there is a court case because PIF are the sponsors of the Breakaway Golf Tournament or Golf Circuit, the LIV Circuit, I think it's called. And they were being sued, and they were saying they were immune because they have sovereign immunity. They are the Saudi state. And so in the UK, they're saying we're not part of the Saudi state. In America, they're saying we are part of the Saudi state. As it turns out, they lost that court case because the judge said, yes, you are part of the Saudi state, but because this is a commercial venture, sovereign immunity doesn't apply to you. So they lost both ways on that. So my question is, what are the Premier League going to do? Because if it's true that they're part of the Saudi state, and that's what they are claiming, that's what they have claimed most recently, then they lied to the Premier League. I don't have an easy way out of it. I mean, it's almost impossible to undo a takeover that's already happened. But it just goes to show just how crap, basically, the owners and directors and the governance of football is. This afternoon in the House of Commons, in Parliament, there was an urgent question asked by Labour about the new government proposals for regulating football. This stems out of the so-called fan-led review, which reported a year ago, which seems to have come up with some pretty decent stuff. The government is now promising a white paper, which for the uninitiated is a delaying tactic. It's a paper that seeks consultation but sets out what they propose to do. It's not actually new legislation. So they'll have a white paper. It'll come out on Thursday. And then at some point after the consultation period is closed, they may get around to actually legislating. So the independent regulator or whatever other changes they might recommend is at least a year away from even being legislated on. But it at least looks like something is going to happen. And you know that something is going to happen because two, if not three, of the very big clubs, in this case, Liverpool and Manchester United, are currently looking for new owners. The existing owners are thinking of selling. And they're desperate to get this through as quickly as possible. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that the named potential buyers of Man U or Liverpool or indeed potentially of Everton are dodgy people. But you can tell that the existing owners, the Glazers and Fenway and so on, would like to be able to sell under the current owners and directors test with its weaknesses, rather than wait until there's a new, potentially much stronger regime in force. So the government needs to get on with this. As much as we might deride the big six and the huge clubs and everything that they do and everything that they stand for, they are the shop window of British football. The Premier League is the biggest league in the world, and that's largely down to the Man Uniteds, the Liverpools, the Cities, and so on. So if they were to get dodgy owners, if they were to get into the sort of trouble that it looks like Man City are in at the moment, financially, then what's going to happen? We need to have that regulator, the independent regulator, and much stronger governance procedures in place as soon as possible in order to make sure that all football clubs are protected, whether it's the Premier League, the Big Six, or those lower down the leagues, or indeed non-league teams as well. So you know, let's have more like Dunstable Town, whose owner has said he will give away the club for free to anybody who is he is convinced will be able to run it properly. Let's have more fan ownership, of course, but let's get it done as quickly as possible, because otherwise we're going to see more and more hassle within our football, and we're going to see clubs go under, and we're going to see more and more go through the courts. And that's not good for football. It's not good for the game we love. Anyway, there's the rant. Thank you very much.
Well said indeed. And as usual, Alex's rants are particularly well-spoken, particularly eloquent, and also phrased in particularly sensible political language, so that no one can actually turn around and be able to sue him afterwards, which is perfectly sensible. Based on BBC headlines, it appears that Man U have received bids, some from various places in the Middle East, and also one from the owner of Ineos, Jim Ratcliffe, who is a self-professed Man U fan, as all his investors seem to claim to be. So who knows what will come out of that. Liverpool are now claiming, based on a question and answer thing that the owner of Fenway did with the Boston Journal, that's been reported on the BBC website, that they're not actually selling, but they are looking for investment. So same thing applies exactly as Alex has just been saying. So another thing that makes us glad about being Wimbledon fans, whatever trials and tribulations we may have. Okay, so George has already touched on that, but I want to just spend a little bit of time. I mentioned the Craig Cope interview. The Craig Cope obviously is our head of football operations, and he came in midway through the transfer window, and therefore he had some influence on what was going on there. We didn't necessarily sign the most stellar players, and we haven't, in my opinion, and we haven't necessarily used them particularly well. But actually, with 12 draws now and 4 draws in the last 6 games, George is probably right, actually, what he said earlier, that it was not realistic for the playoffs anyway. Even before, we didn't beat Hartlepool, and now we've got, you know, Gillingham, resurgent Gillingham, and then Stevenage played twice, and other top-ranking clubs. So what do we reckon to the rest of the season? Are we just going to have to start to blood some new players? Do we get, you know, Morgan Williams and Alfie Bendel back from loans at Eastbourne and Corinthian Casuals and give them a run in the team? Because we're not going to get relegated. So what do we think? What are we going to do with the next 15 games?
Yeah, I've been a big advocate of Alfie Bendel ever since I saw him when he was on trial with the club. What was it now? 18 months ago, something like that. He's a very, very talented player. I'd like to have seen him kept around. And I think, touching on the Hartlepool game, I think Woody hasn't been at his best for a long period of time now. So taking him out, perfect opportunity to put Alfie Bendel in. Morgan Williams, probably not quite the same. Probably looking at more 2 or 3 games rather than 15 for him at the end of the season. But for the one that's most disappointed about me is obviously Jack Curry should be in. Brownie had his best game for us on Saturday, but Jack Curry should be in playing because, let's be honest, he's going to be sold in the summer. And we need to maximise whatever revenue we can get, and him sitting on the bench ain't going to increase his fee any more than it was on deadline day. So we have to play him to maximise what we get from him. And I'd like to have seen Oggs. I know he's gone out and loaned to Dartford, but I'd like to see Oggs start ahead of Gunter. Just, you know, we're not going to go up. We're not going to go down. Let's blood the youngsters and give ourselves the best chance of getting solid footing in time for next season.
I think we've got 2 options. As George says, we're not going to go down. I think it's unrealistic to think we're going to go up or make the playoffs. So the 2 options we got, the first one is to blood the youngsters, as he says. I think certainly we need to do that to a certain extent. Playing Jack Curry as many games as possible makes absolute sense. Lee Brown is a good player, a solid player, but he's not going to get us potentially $1 million or whatever we might be able to get for Jack Curry. The other option is, you know, if we're going to recruit in the summer and we're going to have to recruit some players, then we need to be as attractive as possible to them. If we go into free fall now for the last 15 games, even if we don't go down, we're going to look like a club like we did at the end of last season. And that's not an attractive club to play for. So if we can get somewhere near the playoffs, have a late run, you know, flirt with potentially still getting to the playoffs, anything like that, even if we don't end up going up, that's a much more attractive proposition. So I think we want to be looking at how we can maximize our attraction to whoever might come in the summer, and our team for next year. So that's going to be a judicious balancing of those new players who we think, or those existing players who we think will be part of the team next year, or can do something for us in the way that, you know, being mercenary Jack Curry can, or potentially attracting new players who to fill the gaps that we can see now. So I think it's a balancing act. I don't think there's a one way or the other. But whatever happens, I think we need to be playing a bit more attractive football, simply because I think the fans deserve it. And we had we've had so far a really good attendance rate this season, much higher than I thought it was going to be. And I'm really glad about that. But in order to make sure the fans leave happy at the end of the season and renew their season tickets, we need to make sure that we are an attractive team to come and watch, as well as an attractive team to play for.
One of the things I was going to ask Adam about, because he has a longer commute to even get to the games up from the South Coast than any of us. And Alex is right. We want to be an attractive team to watch. Actually, sadly, on Saturday, you missed one of the better games in terms of the way we tried to play some attacking football, because finally, after however many weeks of everybody asking for it, we played two up front. And the issue, of course, then came by playing two up front. We had a midfield which was pretty stretched, and therefore eventually they just ran straight through the middle of it, which if they continue to play that, which I think everybody wants to play two up front, they've got to find some kind of way of balancing it. I mean, in terms of the games you've watched, Adam, have you been, obviously you like watching the team because you're a fan, but have you been excited about the way we play and the way we're trying to actually achieve attacking football?
I mean, it's been a bit of a weird season, hasn't it, I think, in terms of you look at the performance. I thought it was starting to come together, and then obviously the transfers changed and I've got to get used to these different players and those kind of things. I mean, obviously for me, if a train's running and I'm not working, I'm going to be at the football. So it makes no difference to what actually happens. I might leave more happy or less happy, depending on what's gone on. But I suppose I get more out of it. But yeah, I think I totally agree with what Alex is saying there, is that we do need to finish on a high. We need to bring in those players that we can maximise profit from, for sure, because we want to keep the best players that we've got. We want to attract some better players in some key areas over the summer, of course. We want to have a budget to be able to do that. All those three things sort of go hand in hand. So, you know, I was kind of looking at the table thinking, I don't know, how close could we get? But you mean, look at Bradford, and they've only played 30 games, so they've got like something's going on there. I don't know what that's got. So it'll be tight, but it'll be interesting to finish on a high. And I think that would make us more attractive to keep the attendance up, you know, the second season in at Plough Lane. You know, there might, some of that sort of first proper season with fans kind of thing might drop a little bit. So, you know, I think it is important that we finish on a high. So those who are thinking, oh, it was a nice season, we'll change their mind. And of course, the other thing we've got is that it's the people coming to the ground for the first time, the away travelling fans as well. So that is also going to have an impact potentially next season if we're not seen as a really interesting team to play against and to watch against. So yeah, but I am disappointed that the most exciting game probably so far I wasn't at, and I am frustrated that we haven't scored as many goals as I would have liked, because, you know, and at the end that we sit at. But, you know, that's everyone wants that anyway, don't they? So why would you not say that? But yeah, there's been a lot of draws. And yeah, I mean, my main shock when I looked at the WhatsApp was the fact that we'd scored two goals. I was just like, what is going on?
That we actually sang, we scored a goal, we scored a goal, when we scored the first one, which is one of the more sarcastic things I've ever seen. Since those German football fans got the arrows to point towards their team's goal to actually point out, this is where you actually need to shoot into. But that's never a good sign when the team's being sarcastic themselves. Although we've said lots of positive things about the fans this season and how they kept on going and kept on being positive. Got to actually call out the mover stand, because the jokers in the mover stand, and we all thought it was funny at the time, they did mess around with the ball. They did hold the ball for about a minute or so. which the referee then added. And then, of course, when the ball came back on the pitch, they then threw the ball on the pitch, but the referee added extra time as well. And I had a stopwatch going. They scored at 5 minutes and 56 seconds. Those 56 seconds wouldn't have been played if the movers hadn't messed around with the ball. Not their fault that we couldn't defend properly, but obviously that unfortunately came back to bite us in the ass. Okay, segueing on, part of the real strong reason that we brought George on is because George has been spending some time, along with a devout bunch of supporters, in following the AFC Women's team, which is, as far as I can see, a successful team that scores plenty of goals, that doesn't let in 2-0 leads with 20 minutes left, and actually is continuing to strive and move forward at almost every venture and take on teams above them and, by and large, make a real good account of themselves, but also seems to have about half their season left, based on league games at least. So, George Jones, talk us through it. Where's the women's team getting on? How are they doing? And what are your hopes for the rest of the season? My lover's got no money. He's got his strong beliefs. One more and more. People just want more and more. Freedom and love. What he's looking for. One more and more. People just want more and more. Freedom and love. What he's looking for. Freed from desire. Mind and senses purified.
Yeah, it's going brilliantly. I mean, we've scored, 15 goals in our last two games, which is, you know, a bit of a difference to what we see on a Saturday. And we had a revolutionary idea on this weekend where we were 2-0 up and then attacked and got a third to kill the game off. it's nice to have these things going our way for a while, but we're going well at the moment. It's the best squad we've ever had this year. The girls are a great group of girls. The coaches are brilliant. We're still in the title race. Our league, I'm sure, will come on and talk about the setup of the women's pyramid later on, but it's one up from our league with no playoffs, which makes it an absolutely brutally long season, especially if you don't have a great start where we struggled within that first week. So it's got a lot of games to go, as you said. I mean, where are we now? The end of Feb, near the end of Feb, and we've only played 60% of our season, which is insane. It means we've got all the girls are obviously amateur. They're not, you know, they train twice a week, and we're in a position now where we've got a lot of midweek games between now and the end of the season to fit everything in, which, considering in the first half of the year we had weekends when we didn't have games, is just absolute insanity. So we're in a position now where it's going to be a long physical end to the season, but hopefully we'll end the season hopefully with a title and hopefully with a cup win as well.
Yeah, yesterday you guys played Actonians. Am I right in thinking you do the Twitter feeds as well?
I operate the Twitter feed during the week, not on the match day. We have Karen, who's the club secretary, who does the in-play tweets.
Right.
But
the in-play tweet was very, very funny for anyone who was following it. Because basically, we scored two goals so quickly that whoever was doing it was in the middle of doing the first tweet saying what the denouement was of the first goal. And then we scored the second goal and they just tweeted, I can't keep up with this.
Yeah, it was. So we scored the first goal after about 90 seconds, and it was 2-0 within 2 minutes 20. So there can only have been 30, 40 seconds between the goals, which is, you know, again, more goals than I've seen in the last 2 months with the men's team. But it's a position where we're going forward, and it's great. I mean, Actonians, they're a tough team. We played them a couple of weeks ago, and it was a 2-1 win. I mean, the politest way to describe them is, you know, they're the Wickham of women's football. You can read into that what you will. But I think they're a very solid team. So to go out and get to those two early goals was absolutely massive. And we've booked our spot in the Capital Cup semi-final, where we're going to play Ashford Town Middlesex in a home game, which gives us a great chance of booking our spot in the final, where we'll play either Arsenal Academy or London Bees if we get that far. And obviously London Bees, club with incredible history, used to be Super League and Championship, still in a division above us. So it's a good competition if we're able to win it at the end of the season. And like I said, we're still in the title race.
So let me ask, because I don't know much about our team. They're in a league with only 11 teams.
Yeah.
Third in the league at the moment, with hashtag United, crappy name, but nice people, I'm sure, who seem to be running away with it might be a bit strong, but they're doing pretty well at the moment. And London Seaward, who are just above us. Is there a feeling that this is actually, you know, even with half the games to go, hashtag have basically won it already?
Now, London Seaward, you know, they're second. They used to be Leighton Orient before they split in difficult circumstances, is the way I will word that, at the start of last year. So they've still got a very good group of players from when they were Leighton Orient. But we've got a lot of games in hand. We've got games in hand over them. So it's going to be harsh to them, but they're not in the title race, really, if we're being brutally honest. Hashtag are run by YouTubers and have had a lot of money pumped into them and have a very large social media following. They get good crowds as well. At the moment, they're 8 points ahead of us, with us having a game in hand, and we play them on Sunday. So it's one of those things where it looks over and done with. But if we win our game in hand, which is against the bottom team, who we beat 12-0 last weekend, and then we beat hashtag on Sunday, then all of a sudden we're 2 points behind. And then it's very much, you know, race on. And they've got London Seaward on Wednesday night, sorry. So potentially we win that game, we might even go above them in real terms, if you include, you know, a presumed 3 points against Hounslow. Yes, the 11-team league is disappointing. It's something the women's league have to fix. It's something that the depth of the women's game has improved so much in recent years. There's no reason to be having 12, 14 team leagues. It should be 16, 18 team leagues, and expanding the Super League, expanding the Championship, expanding tier threes and tier fours as well. The reason there's only 11 in our league this year, there was a team that folded right at the start of the season, where it's not actually even a controversial, so I can say why they folded. So they were promoted into our league in the summer. And they were based in Norwich, and Norwich signed their entire squad because Norwich were poor last year. Norwich signed pretty much their entire squad. And as a result, and in Norwich, there's not a massive player base anyway. And Wimbledon, the team that folded, struggled to get a team that they thought would be competitive together. So they folded over the summer, which is a real shame. And Norwich are now fourth in our league, which shows you how good that team actually was. They did the right thing for Norwich, but they've severely damaged a local club in their area, which is a shame to see.
One thing I was going to ask, obviously a lot of the teams you mentioned are based in London and South East, but it does also seem to me, and we appreciate that having 92 league clubs is quite incredible within England anyway, including a few in Wales, obviously, but actually how many of those league clubs have got a active, thriving women's team alongside them? Because it obviously, if there are only 12 in our particular league, it wouldn't appear that necessarily even all of the London professional teams are supporting a women's team.
They all have women's teams. They've got massive variations in terms of the resources and the effort they put in. We're quite lucky, especially over the last year or so, where we've had a great relationship. Obviously, Sophia Ackerson, our general manager, started a year ago. She's working full-time in a club. Danny Macklin's been great ever since he joined as well. And we're getting more and more integrated and getting more and more opportunities at Plough Lane. You know, three of our last four home league games, are at Plough Lane, which is incredible. You've got some teams, Cambridge United are in our league. They're playing a lot of their games at the Abbey Stadium now, their men's ground. So you've got a lot of teams that are closely integrated, but then you've got some teams like Brentford, who only started up their women's team a couple of years ago in a two divisions below us, which for a Premier League club is, you know, they could be putting more in and letting them use their ground and doing all these things, considering they're a new setup. But there is more and more. And I think most, if not all, of the 92 have a women's team. And sadly, some clubs do it a lot better than the others.
So, George, you mentioned earlier that there was like some weekends where the games weren't played, and now there's a load of like midweek games coming. So obviously it's difficult for those who are not professional, obviously, because they've got to juggle everything around. But it also that obviously must have an impact on crowd attendance. Obviously, you know, we just get into a Tuesday night game for the men's one is as tricky as it is. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, I think there's been discussions before about, you know, if we want to use Plough Lane more for this, we need the crowd. So do you see that they're going to look at the fixtures again? I mean, how are the fixtures created, you know, for the next season?
Yeah, so the fixtures are done in the same way as the men's team, where you just get them sent through from the league. You do get a pick the teams that, well, you can request teams that you would like to play scheduled midweek games against, which does make sense. However, you don't always get them, especially where in London, where there's just, you know, we'd obviously want to play all our midweek games against West London teams. But we've got London Seaward actually is our midweek game coming up, and they play in Walthamstow. So getting all the girls who live in southwest London, or a couple of them live out in Reading and Kent, to get them all to Walthamstow on a Wednesday night is not going to be fun for them and not ideal preparations. And so midweek games are always going to have a harder attendance, and you're always going to struggle to get people through the door for them. But the bigger problem is the free Sundays at the start of the season. Because football, as we all know, is a routine. You go there, you know, every Saturday you're going to football. And if women's games, if you're playing one weekend, then you're not, and then you've got an away game, then you've got a weekend off, then you're playing at home, and then it's all a bit, you know, a bit of a mix. It puts you in a position where you can't plan, you can't get people into that routine, which means that, yeah, you're getting people on one-off occasions, but you're struggling to build them into a routine of coming every week. So, for example, we played Hounslow, who, like I said, they're the team at the bottom. We beat them 12-0 last weekend. That was our first home league game since October, which is insanity. And it makes it so difficult because you've got cup games in that period where you're getting a week, 2 weeks' notice. You can't build up that routine. It's a struggle to get at the men's stadium because obviously they want more notice to put tickets on sales for Lukey, the groundsman, to look after the pitch. It's something that I think that I'd love it to be looked at so they can front load the fixtures more, so you get less, more fixtures at the start of the season guaranteed on set dates, and then maybe leave 3 weekends for cups a bit later on. So you've built them into that routine. But it is very difficult, and the winter we've had ain't great. And then also the league finishes, it's 30th of April is the final game. If they extend it by another 2 weeks to mid-May, which is reasonable, the men's team is running a week longer than us, and they start 2 weeks earlier than us this year, an extra three weekends is massive, considering we're only meant to have 4 midweek games. It's not difficult to find an extra couple of Sundays here and there to get rid of midweek games altogether.
We're talking to George Jones, the Women's Media Officer at AFC Wimbledon. A lot of us know George. George has done loads of volunteering around the club and still continues to do so. And obviously this role you're doing is a volunteer role, George. As you said, the players themselves are not paid. Am I right in thinking that? Are they all just volunteers as they're doing things?
They get expenses, but none of them, they don't get paid in general, no.
And I guess in that particular respect, then we're going to get players from different levels. Is it a bit like sort of now the players we've got in League Two in the men's team, whereby they may have played at a higher level but got an injury and wouldn't have been able to maintain the same standards? Or do you get promising 17, 18-year-olds? I don't know whether or not we've been around long enough to get a youth policy coming through. So you've got the equivalent of an Alfie Bender in the women's team.
Yeah, it's a mixture. It's the same as it is in the sort of lower levels of men's football, where you have a mixture of girls who come through our girls' system and come through. We've got a couple of them. You know, Rosie Russell played her 100th game for us the other weekend at the age of 12. She's just turned 21, actually, Rosie. So for 100 games, when you're playing 25 games a year, to get to 100 games by 21 is incredible. She's been at Wimbledon since she was 10, I think. She joined us. Remy Gardner's another who's come through the girls' section and attacking midfielder, very promising. Sadly, she's out with injury at the moment. But you've got a lot of really good, talented girls come through, and the girls' system is always looking to improve and generate more players to come into our first team. Then when you're looking at signings, you've got players who do come down and who have played Championship football or Super League football. You know, Ashley Hinks is obviously probably the best known of those for us, but she's played for Chelsea and played for England at age group level. Faye Baker's played a lot at Super League and Championship. And then you get others who you pick up having come from a local club or a lower level club anyway, who are promising. And Ella Newman's an example for that, where we signed her from Worthing earlier this year, who's an outstanding fullback. And like I said, then you've got players who have the commitment. So we signed Fran Alley this week, which we announced on Saturday, who we've signed from Watford, who's an absolutely incredibly gifted central midfielder, who is just, it's the structure that, of what we do and the personalities we've got in the group that appeal to her. So it's a real mix of where players have come from in their football journeys, but you'd expect that in men's football as well.
Is it also then, I guess, a little inevitable that you'll get a lot of chopping and changing of clubs? I mean, I remember in lockdown, I watched something like a BBC 4 documentary that was about West Ham ladies. And I tried to follow West Ham a little bit since then, only to find that basically none of those players that they featured at the time still play for West Ham anymore. They all play professionally in the top level, but for loads of different clubs, and that's only 2 years ago.
Yeah, you do get a massive turnover of players, and even at the higher levels, where a lot of it is to do with groups, personalities, managers, you know, in the same, because women's footballers are not massively paid, even in the Super League, they're nowhere near as highly paid as they should be. So the record transfer fee, it was going to be broken in the January window, but it wasn't. It was only 400 grand, and that would have been a world record fee, or a British fee, sorry. And that shows you the money that's in there. So for players, it's much more about the group, or if they've got a friend or a partner playing at a different club, then it becomes much more of a thing. And that was a case in that West Ham documentary where you had girls who were partners or had a partner's play for other clubs nearby. And if one of those moves abroad or moves to a northern club, for example, then they tend to follow because they're not paid enough to justify being 200 miles away from people they care about.
Yeah, that's reasonable. And I think actually a couple of players in the England professional women's team are in that situation as well, where a couple of them have gone to, I want to say, Barcelona, possibly.
Yeah, Barcelona.
Okay, two quick things I wanted to touch on just to wrap things up, because this has been really useful and, you know, delighted to have you on, George, and please come on more regularly. I noticed a couple of tweets from John Green. Apparently he's got involved with the ladies team and supplied a little bit of finance. And apparently since he's got involved, they've just won every game. So can he get back involved with the men's team, please?
Yeah, John Green's been absolutely brilliant. He was obviously a great supporter of the men's team for several years. But he's come in, he's got a sponsorship deal with us for the rest of this year. And hopefully he'll enjoy it and fall in love with it and stick around for next season as well, because the Women's League is, you know, none of our players get paid more than expenses, but it's still incredibly expensive to run a women's section, especially if we're wanting to integrate at Plough Lane and do all of these things and do things the right way. Then it becomes, you know, you do need resources, and John Green and all the other sponsors are great coming into that. And going on, we talked about league structure briefly, but our league is, at the moment, it's the South East, which is why there's London. I mean, the furthest we have to go is Norwich. If we get promoted this year, we have to go into a league which is the whole of the South of England and Wales. So you've got to go to places like Cardiff, Plymouth, Exeter look like they might be in that league next year as well. And then your costs go through the roof, because then every weekend you're looking at hotel fees and coach travel fees, the same as the men do, which is a massive cost for a club which is effectively still amateur in terms of pay structure.
And then possibly you're going to be faced with this dilemma as to whether or not you end up going to Morecambe on a Saturday afternoon or Cardiff to get organised and help out with ladies. And something tells me, George, maybe you might be favouring the ladies over Morecambe or somewhere else in League Two.
Yeah, it's the women's teams have been great. I've been involved with the women's team for about 18 months now in a proper official role rather than just going to games. And it's great. I mean, this, you know, we train twice a week. We play Sundays. We've got midweek games Wednesday as well. So it is time consuming. And next, when we go up, because it is a win, it'll either be this year or next year, realistically, if we're honest. And then we go into that situation. And then it's absolutely brilliant. I'm loving being involved. I've missed games, which I never thought I would do, for the men's team to just go to training with the women's team, because it's such an incredible group of people they've got there. The girls are great. The coaching staff are absolutely brilliant as well. It's a really great structure, and we'd appreciate all the support we can get.
And yeah, I think that's great to hear. And we completely understand if people are wanting to follow and give their support morally and physically to teams that, you know, also are more than surviving, actually thriving overall. And as you said, we've got some games coming up at Plough Lane. When's the next one up at Plough Lane then? Obviously, they play at Coshalton as well as Plough Lane. So fans shouldn't just come just because it's at Plough Lane. But when is the next one at Plough Lane?
So the next one at Plough Lane is Sunday, the 5th of March, where we're playing Chesham in a league game. And that'll be a tough test. We played them last year in a cup game at Plough Lane and they gave us a late scare, but we were able to hold on for the win. It's again, you know, we'll hopefully still be in the title race when those games come around. So 5th of March, 2nd of April and the 30th of April are our next games at Plough Lane for the rest of this year. And it'd be great to have as many people down as we can. Tickets are affordable. They're only a fiver for adults, under 18s getting for free. It's a great thing, and you can have a beer in your seat, which is, I think, a lot of people enjoy and get some, you know, a lot of people coming down.
Bonus, absolute bonus. And also, if you follow Sam West, the actor and playwright, he's a big Roman fan and he posts about stuff he does. He's in All Creatures Great and Small, if that's your flavour of TV right now. And he's also got a couple of younger daughters who he brings to games and he brings to the women's games as well and posts about it. So, yeah. that's always good to see, and great to hear a positive news story and a team whose season, by the sound of it, by no means is going to just splutter to a rather frustrating and premature end, as it looks like possibly the men's team will do, so to speak. So good luck to the women's team. Thank you, George, for coming on. And fingers crossed we can get you back in at the end of the season to tell us of a triumphant end to the season.
Let's hope so. Thank you.
Fingers crossed. All right, gentlemen, we're going to wrap it up now with our numbers game, just to finish off. For George, we've got a very simple, very straightforward one, which, needless to say, does relate to the women. So George's number is number 72.
That is a very good... Was that the minute that we got the third on Sunday?
You're doing an Adam here. No, these numbers are never that particularly obscure. They're just like a number of things that have happened, as opposed to a minute or, you know, 15 things happened in
oh, Hinksey's goals since she joined last summer.
Based on the information on the FC Women and Women's website, 72 goals scored by Ashley Hinks.
In 52 games.
In how many games?
52 or something like that, and 30-odd assists in that time as well.
That is obscenely good. That makes what Kevin Cooper way back in the day achieved almost simple and not very good, so to speak. Okay, Adam's number this week is 9.
I don't know why you even bothered to ask me. I was hoping you'd ask.
I sent you this in a tweet and you said that's a good stat, so I thought you might remember it.
Ah, good. Thank you very much. I was kind of hoping you might say minus 112, because that's Hanslow's goal difference in the women's league, which is unbelievable.
That is unbelievable. Yes.
Yeah, I was hoping that the stats might be on the sheet I'm looking at. And the 9 was the I've got to remember now. So it's the longest non-defeat that we've had for ages or something in the men's team.
Longest non-defeat. Does anyone understand that in English? Yes. It's the number of games we were unbeaten at home is what you're trying to say. But you basically
longest non-defeat.
Yeah. But that, unfortunately, that's 5 draws and only 4 wins.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the longest unbeaten run at home we've had since 2015, apparently.
Which I think is I think that's a great stat. That's why I'm quite interested to see what happens for the rest of the season. I think it could be quite interesting. Especially if we're scoring goals.
We've only got Stevenage next. Okay. Final number for tonight is 50 for Alex. 50. This is a bit of a harsh one, but it's about scoring goals or not scoring goals.
I have no idea. I mean, we went a huge number of minutes without scoring a goal. It can't be. We went longer than 50 minutes without scoring a goal and less than 50 hours of play. So, no, I don't know. You're going to have to put me out.
Who's our centre forward?
Oh, Josh Davison has not scored for 50 games. No, he can't. That can't be true. He's had 50 shots since he scored.
It's 50 days since Josh Davison scored.
Okay.
Yeah, he scored on New Year's Day. He scored 2 in a row, actually. He scored at Colchester between Christmas and New Year. Then he scored the consolation goal at Sutton when we lost. And he hasn't scored since then. So 50 days since
less. I mean, let's face it, he tries his hardest. He's one of those centre forwards who runs all over the pitch and works for the team. And I admire him for that. I just wish he'd get the ball in the back of the net.
I agree 100%. I actually saw him as he was walking back with his girlfriend and I think his parents after the game a couple of weeks ago. And I thought he'd played quite well and he hadn't done very well, but he'd been like pulled and pushed and had his shirt ripped and stuff. And he said, yeah, he had his shirt ripped he was given a nosebleed by an elbow in the face within the first 2 minutes, neither of which were given as free kicks, which is just League 2 football for you.
Well, on Saturday, his bigger problem was actually keeping his hair in check. The man bun disappeared and we had the full flowing locks at one stage, which elicited a comment from somewhere near me of, that's the longest hair I've seen on a man for many, many years. But he got it into a ponytail quickly enough. But yeah, if we're commenting on his hair more than we are on his goals, that's a bit worrying. But I mean, I'm a big fan of his. I think he does work a huge amount and I'd keep him in the team simply because of his work rate. He's not a goal hunting, toe it in and that's it, and then waltz back to take the kickoff. It's he's a good player, and I think he's done a lot for us.
And fingers crossed, we haven't talked about the head of football operations. We'll talk about him in a future date. But if he's looking for the type of player that we need as Wimbledon and the fans will engage with and react to, Josh Davidson is definitely one of those that we want to actually bring on board and continue to bring on board that type of player for next season.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good stuff. All right. Well, we'll leave it there for this evening. Thank you very much to Alex Folkes. Thank you to Adam. Big thanks to George Jones for eloquently explaining how the ladies are getting on. Good luck to women are getting on, excuse me. Good luck to them for their midweek fixes this week. There is a meet the manager and meet both Danny Macklin and Craig Cope tomorrow, Tuesday the 21st, down at Ploughland, if people are able to make that in person. I understand it's not being live streamed, so you have to get there in person to understand what they've got to talk about. But for now, we've been Same Old Wombles, episode 26. You can find us on all the usual places where you find your podcasts that I always forget every week, but certainly including Spotify. And thank you very much for listening, and good night.